And I'm just going to have a few. I just wanted to just say a little bit and then let me watch the film, and then just kind of hopefully the film will kind of inspire a couple of questions, I'd like to think. But I'll just say about a little bit about how the film came about. This is kind of the sort of film that kind of television used to make about 10, 15 years ago and doesn't make now. This got made because I got funding from the Department for International Development and their documentary fund. And I went out and I filmed half of it on a small camera myself. And so after 4 years of saying to the BBC that the anniversary of the first genocide of the 20th century was coming up and them ignoring me, by presenting them with half the film and saying, if you give me half the money you would normally give me to make a film, then you can have a film at half cost and it might just be kind of an important story. And eventually, by giving them half the film and using my holiday to go out and do that, they agreed, partly just to stop just going on about it, I think, to allow this film to be made. It was made in 2003. It was broadcast in 2004, the anniversary of the genocide. Next year is the anniversary, the end of the genocide. So in that whole period in which I've been writing a book on the same subject is the time span over which 80% of the Herero and 50% of the Nama people of Southwest Africa were exterminated. And I was going to keep that in mind, that when I first started that project, it was the beginning of their suffering, and that even now, people who are in the camps or who are in the battles, you know, it's the same time period and it's still not over. So kind of next year is the kind of the end of their story, the anniversary of the end. But I think the thing about this document that I kind of like, even though there's lots of things wrong with it because of lack of money and my own deficiency in skills, is that I made it with the stipulation that I wouldn't question whether or not it was a genocide. And this is, the Americans made a film, an American independent company made a film on the same subject, and their film, it was all about whether or not it was a genocide. And there's a whole academic discipline which applies Lemkin's definition of genocide to every event and decides which ones are genocides and which ones aren't, as if that matters. And the sand Bushmen, who were one of the victims of what the Germans did, they're not in this film. They had this amazing story, which Lawrence van der Post writes about they had a war in which one person was killed, and their entire two tribes decided they would never ever meet again because they'd had this war, even though only one person had been killed, and they would never meet again. And for centuries they lived apart in different parts of the desert, and they would never meet again because they felt something terrible had happened when they'd come together. And their argument was that one person's death was enough, and that person had suffered so much. It doesn't matter that lots of people weren't killed, that one person's death was an horrific event. And that they don't count deaths in numbers the way that we're obsessed with slavery, with genocide, with the Holocaust. And so I wanted to make this film the way the Americans hadn't, which was not questioning whether it was genocide, but to make it exactly the same way as I would make a film about the Jewish Holocaust. If I made a film about the Jewish Holocaust, the question whether it was a genocide or not, I'd lose my job. That would be a blessing at the moment. In the BBC. If I was German and did that, I'd end up in court. And so I wanted to apply the same standards that we apply to British, sorry, to European people who died in concentration camps, to Africans who died in concentration camps. And that was kind of the guiding principle. I think I hope that comes across in the film. So I'll stop talking about it. And I'll also say that I can't bear to watch my own films. And
we'll give you a shout. Film,
but yeah.
Cheers.
I'm kind of crap at speeches. So does anyone have any questions? I can kind of talk about it.
I was wondering, in the time you're describing, were there any other indigenous peoples there at all? What were the German settlers' attitudes to that?
The people in the north of the Bambo, they couldn't really touch because of malaria.
Right.
So they were saved by being above the malaria line. Which countless African peoples. So there's a great story that when the Ghanaian parties under Nkrumah were looking for a flag for Ghana, one contingent of the ruling, soon to be ruling elite, seriously suggested that the mosquito should go on the flag. Mm-hmm. That's what had stopped colonization. So the Ibambo were safe. The Sand Bushmen were later not exterminated, but there was essentially a policy towards the SAN, the same as there was a policy towards rabbits in Australia, that they could be shot on sight. The SAN are, you know, amazingly kind of elusive and independent people. And there was nothing like the sort of numbers killed, but they did suffer terribly. And there was a kind of a feeling that they were a form of vermin, that not an invasive species, but an unwelcome figure on the landscape. And you could legally shoot a bushman and get away with it until, you know, throughout the period of German colonialism. They were the only peoples. Well, there are other peoples on the kind of on the border, but it gets complicated because there were constantly people trying to escape the Boers. Mm-hmm. So the Nama were people who'd escaped from the Cape. Because, I mean, you know, they're just one of those who can spend much time in Cape Town. You can understand it because I do it around, you know, bars and restaurants, trying to get away from the Boers. Is the kind of the big engine for, you know, migration. All the equivalent situation in Zimbabwe today, the Ndebele people who are being persecuted, they're in Zimbabwe because they got away from the Cape because they wanted to escape the Boers. So there's always people coming up, but the Germans wanted to exterminate people who had land and cattle, not people who lived in the desert and you could sustain themselves. You want to exterminate people because you want their land. So the Herero were the main target because they had the most.
Have you shown this documentary in Germany?
It's been shown in Germany in a festival season, but it's never been shown on German television. Mm-hmm. In my experience of kind of festivals and history and in Germany, I think there's a huge number of people in Germany absolutely kind of, you know, really open to questioning the Kaiserreich, the Second Reich. And it's, you know, I think Germany's, you know, for the most part, a fantastically liberal country there, and the book that we're writing about this subject, I know it's going to be published in Germany. And I think, you know, that Germany is becoming a country that is willing to accept the myth that was created at Nuremberg, really, that the Nazis were an aberration, an exception, a deviation from the normal path of European history. I think that idea, that was in some ways almost necessary, the historians like Mienko who wanted to create it in 1948, it's kind of run out of time. It's not sustainable. And once you start seeing what the Third Reich was as part of a longer continuum in European history, you end up back in colonialism, as Hannah Arendt, the great German historian, I'm sure you know, kind of pointed out quite a long time ago. And, you know, roads lead back to colonialism. The path is two ways. And, you know, what a lot of really interesting Indian scholars are writing about now is how did colonialism change European societies? We're so used to this idea that looking at what did we do to them and how did we destroy their culture, but what did having doing that do to Germany? What did administering India do to Britain? What did having to create thousands and thousands of colonial administrators do to the British public school system, to the university system? And, you know, George Orwell's the great kind of example of someone who kind of saw through that factory of creating these kind of violent, colonial, masculine figures. So I think Germany's kind of much more open these days to looking to see what their empire did to them. In a way, I think, you know, Britain isn't.
No,
not yet. Indians are going to make us more aware.
I mean, I was sitting there thinking, like, you know, you could show some BBC, and then, you know, probably, you know, in Germany they could show a film about Britain. You know.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing to me is like, you know, we've got people walking around the streets still, like who did terrible, terrible things in Kenya, like, you know, just in one place alone, let alone Malaya and everywhere else, but. Kenya, you know, classic example, like nobody knows. Mm. You know, you go down to the Empire and Commonwealth Museum and there's a little bit in there and you see a Mau Mau rifle and you think, oh, there was a bit of a colonial struggle there. But it's only recently that book came out, you know, Britain's Gulag. And you start to see that, you know, we completely destroyed all the records. So it's very, very hard to get a grip on how many people were put in concentration camps in Kenya. And it's, I don't know, 1.2 million or something. You know, and that's, you know, that's something in our, you know, literally in our lifetimes, you know, I mean, it's unbelievable to me that that's not. It's not. We're not talking about some 19th century thing. Oh well, you know, it's way back. It's, you know, 1950s.
But it's true everywhere.
Unbelievable.
It's true in every colonial country.
But the point is the colonies have been a separate world. The colonies have been a world where dreadful things happen. In some ways, Africa's just replaced the colonial world. as a generic place. Africa is this place where terrible things happen. It's the heart of darkness. It's the shorthand you will just hear repeatedly in the news industry. Bad things happen there. That world exists in isolation. It has no bearing and no importance, really, for the European world. Well, things did. I mean, what happened in German Southwest Africa seeped back into Germany. To the people who were involved in that Holocaust, and Franz Ritter von Epp, in this one, he's only one of them. There's a long list of people who were involved in these sort of things, who were later, you know, horrible, you know, just deeply involved in some of the worst things in the First World War, never mind the Third Reich. It was two-way traffic. You can't do these things in a bubble. You can't seal them. I think, you know, Britain, France, Belgium, Germany, all of these countries, you know, there is now, I think, slowly a kind of appreciation that the reason the 20th century took on the form that it did is because in the last quarter of the 19th century, terrible, dark things happened. There's a fantastic book, John Ellis's book, The Social History of the Machine Gun, and he talks about the incredulity of the British and German and French general staff when they discovered that the Maxim gun meant wars of movement and cavalry were completely defunct, and that you couldn't, you know, the Elan of the French cavalry wasn't going to overcome the Maxim gun. And they were confused because they'd spent 30 years using this gun against Africans, but they'd been convinced that the reason the Maxim gun was effective against Africans was because Africans were inefficient people. They didn't have the discipline, the inner core of white Europeans. Nothing to do with 400 rounds a minute. It was to do with the racial inferiority of the people who were being exterminated by this gun. And they were literally surprised that they weren't arriving in Berlin on horseback with their saber. The depth to which the colonial experience was seen to be irrelevant to everything else, to me, I think the story of the Maxim gun is the best story to reveal that. They didn't expect the Western Front, because the people they'd fired these weapons against had been inferior, and they died because they were inferior. And in some ways, they were supposed to die. That was the Darwinian point, what this war was. And Trotter wrote a, which I wish I'd put in this film, Trotter wrote a fantastic illuminating letter in 1897 when he'd left East Africa, which was the first genocide he was involved in. He was also involved in the genocide in China. And he said that what's begun in East Africa, this is the opening salvo of a racial war that's inevitable and it's going to come. And he pleads with the general staff to see that we need to prepare ourselves. If we want a space of what he calls the black space, the space of the black man, the space that the black man's going to leave empty because he has no future, we have to begin our war to destroy them earlier. This presumption that these people were going to die out because that was ordained because Darwin had said this is so strong. It's so strong within the Germans, but so strong within the British. And the great British example is, if you look at the Tasmanian genocide, a lot of rubbish is said about the Tasmanian genocide. Most of the people involved in that, on the official level, everything other really than the settlers, they were racked with guilt about it. The British did more to stop that genocide than I think they've ever been given credit for. Everyone, they tried to stop it, they did everything they could, they produced posters, they tried to bring them, the Tasmanians in, they desperately tried to stop it happening because they feared for their souls. That's the fundamental reason, because they were Christians. They believed that they would have to answer to their maker. Why had they killed these innocent people who for millennia had lived on this island by themselves? By the time the last of the Tasmanians dies in the 1870s, that death is seen as a celebration because it's proof of Darwin's theory. Darwin's destroyed religion. That here is the proof. The advance of the white race is the proof that the fit will survive. So you need the other half of the equation. You need to see somewhere in the world the dark races dying out. You need to prove that the great cosmic process of the weak dying and the strong living is happening. And this terrible event that the British are terrified and really upset about, I mean, literally, people are, you know, Governor Arthur, his diary is full of concern about what he's done in Tasmania in the 1830s. By the 1870s, it's this thing to be celebrated. The death of the Tasmanians proves that Darwin's principles apply to humanity, and these things are going to happen, they're inevitable. So the Herero, they have no future. It's not really killing people if they have no future. It's inevitable, it's going to happen anyway. Don't worry about it.
Can I ask, the current Namibian government, what are they involved in backing the, I saw that you took there was a reparations committee.
Yeah.
Are they
yeah.
involved in backing that?
Well, here we get really.
And then also, are they. Does the state, has the state broadcast it?
It was broadcast in Namibia, yeah.
And also South Africa.
It has been broadcast in South Africa. Here I have to slide off the BBC, which I'm not supposed to do. the South Africa Broadcasting Corporation can't pay enough to interest BBC Worldwide in cashing their cheque. And so they don't really care because, but we essentially, we film people around the world. We don't give a damn about them being an audience. They're subjects in the kind of tradition of Nanook of the North. They're our subjects. We don't care. We don't really want to cash their cheque. So it has been booked in South Africa, even though they offered to pay, the BBC just didn't really want to be asked for them. So no, it has been broadcast. But the situation in Namibia is complicated because the government is a Swakopmund government, it's dominated by the Ovambo, and they fought a terrible, long, and immensely kind of brave struggle against the South Africans. And that's the story that they want to be the national struggle. They don't really want the Herero and Nama suffering to become the centre of a form of national identity. They dominate numerically, partly because the Herero and Nama were exterminated by the Germans. And there is an element of tribalism within that. And I find that a saddening reality. It's also a reality that was part of the German system and of the apartheid system is to accentuate tribal differences. And if you go to Katatrua, which is the slums of Windhoek, people's address has in what tribe they are. So if you're Herero, you might live in H and then the number. If you're Nama, then it'll be I think it's Hot, which is the German for Hottentot. So those divisions that now I think are stopping Namibia fully grasping its history, some of them are created by apartheid. But the other fact is that there has been a long historiography of denial about what happened. I mean, the myth of denying that this happened began. It's amazing. It's one of those events where they start their denying before they've even finished the killing. I think the only other event that is really like that is the American Wars of Extermination against the Indians. In 1905, in January 1905, by Governor Lindqvist, who comes to replace Trotter, when he arrives in Swakopmund, he goes to the Herero and he makes them recite. He reads them this speech, which he says, "You're to blame for this war because you rejected the merciful kindness of his All Highness the Kaiser." And the Herero have to say, "Yes, we did." And then they say, "But you'll now be safe and you'll have a new place in our society." And they actually have to recite blame for starting a war when everybody knows. It was a classic kind of amazing kind of moment of Stalinist kind of a doublethink. But that process of saying, "Well, no, this didn't happen the way it really happened," began while it was still happening. And as a result, it's only, 18 years since Namibian independence. The first generation of indigenous black Namibian historians are just now finishing their MAs. And, they're the kind of great hope, I think, for Namibia. And I meant to say, and I didn't, before the film was shown, there's some really horrible images in this film, as you saw. One of the human heads is now believed to be the head of Cornelius Fredericks, who was one of the Nama leaders. Now, his grandson is a historian who's training under Casper Eriksson, who's in the film. He's the co-author of the book that I'm writing. I mean, his grandfather's skull, his grandfather's head, is in a jar in a hospital university, the Charité University in Berlin, which you put in there. They have these nine Nama heads, and so his grandfather's head is in a pickled jar in a hospital in Berlin. And this guy is going to be an historian. If anybody has the kind of the personal and the right character to be kind of the person who unravels this story, for the Namibian people themselves, it'll be the descendants. And so there is kind of hope in terms of the new generation.
Are they trying to ask you for your heads back?
That's what's happening at the moment. They admitted, this is kind of something that I'm involved in. They've admitted they've got them. Well, actually, fantastically, a worker at the hospital leaked a letter to a friend of mine saying, yeah, yeah, we do have them, an internal document, after lots and lots of denial. There's going to be a formal request probably next year, but there's other material. I mean, there's material all over Germany. It's just incredible, I mean, just the amount of material. There's a guy called Felix von Luschen, who was involved in the great the Germans had a big colonial show, a massive event in Treptow Park in 1896. This was freezing cold. A number of people died. And they're like vampires, the skull measurers, the racial anthropologists. And they kind of pounced on all of these people. And his collection is in our university in Berlin. So, you know, the Germans are just beginning to come to terms with it. I mean, Britain's ahead of the game because we haven't got the guilt of the Nazis. I mean, that's the great problem, is that the history of the Third Reich totally eclipses the history of the Second Reich. And Germany's kind of, many Germans feel they've done enough of, you know, self-flagellation, and they don't want this story to come out. Whereas Britain, you know, we are beginning to work out that, you know, the Empire was the thing that we need to, you know, along with slavery and many other things in Ireland, is the thing that we should, you know, feel concerned about. So Britain's ahead of the game in terms of sending material back to Australia and places like that. The Germans are just beginning.
On that subject, though, of films about British colonialism, how easy is it to make films about such two subjects in this country?
Well, I would like to think that the abolition season that we had, apart from the programmes that were truly awful in that season, you know, shows. I do think Britain is a kind of society where you can write books and discuss, and to a lesser extent make programmes about these things. I think, you know, having spent a bit of time in Belgium, you know, the contrast with some countries is quite stark. I think one of the great strengths of Britain is that we are ahead of the game, with a long way to go, I stress, in accepting this. And I spent most of my career as a filmmaker making programmes about the darker parts of British history, which is why I kind of find it slightly ironic when the German ambassador maybe condemns me for making this film. And I Robert Salter and many, many more Britain's wounds than this. The Germans are just so, to some extent, understandable, so kind of upset about another story coming out, because it undermines the central myth that the Nazis were an aberration. That's a really, really important way of making sense of what happened under the Nazis. It's such an important pillar of post-war, post-denazification Germany, that to see cracks in it is quite frightening.
I'd argue that myth as well is really important, because it's not just a German myth, it's a European myth. It's really important.
Well, the great thing I always think about Nuremberg is that some of the Russian prosecutors at Nuremberg condemning the Nazis when in concentration camps were themselves people who had sent thousands of people to the Gulag. And the fact that British and French and American judges sat beside people who oversaw the Gulag and condemned the Germans for concentration camps shows, I mean, you know, the crimes that people were condemned for at Nuremberg were abhorrent, and there's no point, you know, questioning that. But it was a show trial, and it was an ahistorical trial, because, you know, it didn't. It's really interesting. In Nuremberg, Goering's asked one question about his life before 1914. That's one question. And he starts a sentence saying, my father was the first governor consul of German Southwest Africa, and he met Kitchener, and he gets cut off. And Goering has this moment where he's saying, actually, and he says, he describes them, I can't remember the phrase, he says, things which are pertinent to my later development. And then he talks about his father and Germany's Second World Empire, and he's cut off by Justice Jackson, the American prosecutor. And I was at the tantalising moment where Nuremberg might have actually, you know, looked further back than 1914, which is year zero for them, that Europe's decline started at the First World War, started at the First Battle of Ypres, and everything was lovely up until then. And there's, you know, this, you know, Larkin's Edwardian world of moustaches and happy people. But, you know, 1914 was the beginning of the abyss. Well, you know, the beginning of the abyss was, well, I think 1871, with Darwin's publication of Descent of Man. But everything that happened in the colonies just got, it gets in the way. It gets in the way of a very simple argument that something went wrong in Europe in 1933, and we sorted it out by 1945, and now it's all done and dusted and together back. Such a really comforting way of thinking about it. They were monsters. They were not like us. They were abhorrent. Somehow they got in charge of this very cultured German, you know, European country, and it went off the rails of normality. But now it's gone. The monster's gone. We can all forget about it.
And you can imagine.
Yeah, it was a fraud.
You can imagine that if this film, if these ideas start to be developed, let's say these colonial crimes, then there'll be a kind of revisionist response, which will say, of course, you know, the British Empire was, you know, we didn't lose it. We were much more organised, and we could control things a lot better. So, you know, it's a shame that these people lost it. You know, they didn't use the right tactics. You know, and they were cruel. And whereas the British Empire were much better with administrators than that. We didn't need to get to the situation of extermination. You know, we just used our slave labourers much more effectively. And that's what I imagine will happen to a certain extent.
I think the other thing that's interesting is that the only thing I think is distinctive about Germany, with the possible exception of the structure of their army and its relationship to the civilian command, the only thing I think is different is that they were a continental country who looked to Eastern Europe in a way that the French and the British and the other European nations didn't. And they were able to apply onto East European people the same status that other European nations had only applied to people with dark skin. And that they were able to consider the Slavic peoples of Russia and Poland as what Hitler called them, colonial peoples. Hitler said, we will take the land from the Ukrainians with beads, as if they were native peoples. I mean, he repeatedly says these things. That's the only difference, is that the last great colonial war was the invasion of the USSR. And that's not a trajectory we want to talk about. We want to talk about Stalingrad, we want to talk about Hitler in the bunker and all that sort of stuff, because that's kind of, it's about big battles. But the idea that was an attempt to build an enormous empire, that's too complicated. And it gets in the way of the great epic story that monsters took over Germany and the good countries overcame and killed those monsters and they were slain. And the way that the Nazis were treated at Nuremberg is amazing. It was this idea that they were monsters. After the executions, their bodies were cremated and then they were kind of dumped in an unnamed river, and all their possessions were. It is this kind of idea of getting rid of vampires, as if by dumping Goering's ashes in an unnamed river, that the ideas that had motivated his life and his father's life somehow disappear. It's so much more comforting and so much more childish to believe in monsters.
But it was a fraud, because actually the majority of Nazis was hired by the United States government.
Yeah. What's actually fascinating is that the Americans, people like Zawelski, is one of the worst in the punitive raids in the Ukraine. He was hired by the American government, because when the Cold War first begins, they know nothing about the Red Army. So somebody whose ideology, understanding of the Russians, is based on Slavic racism, the pan-Germanic form of Slavic racism, which in some ways is developed by Friedrich Ratzel, that he's the guy advising the Americans on what the Russians would do. This guy with an entirely racial frame of mind is telling the Americans, if you do this, the Russians will behave this way, because that's the way these Slavic peoples do, because that's the way their brain works, because they're not like you and I, who are all Europeans, you know. And it's fascinating how, you know, the people who had really been involved in the colonial aspects of the war in the East end up in Washington and in the Rand Institute, things like that.
Yeah, and
in Latin America, because many of the Nazis were actually hired by the CIA, sent to Latin America, allowed to, etc., and they worked with them hand in hand to treat the Latin American
In Namibia, there's a phrase for the old German men who still live there. They call them Bush Nazis. And you meet people, and I mean, they literally are. My co-author, Kasper, is in this film. His neighbour, I've got a picture of his neighbour's car. It's an old Toyota, and it's got a swastika and Remember Dresden on the back. And it's only been the past kind of 5 years that they've been stopped celebrating the Battle of Waterberg. The Alte Kameraden used to go to the battle with their three-legged swastika, would go to the Battle of Waterberg, to the German graves, and hold a ceremony. The Pfadfinders, which is their version of the Hitler Youth, who have been in existence since the 20s. I mean, they haven't, they were never disbanded. But maybe it was a kind of a place where you could actually still, you know, celebrate the 18th of April, Hitler's birthday. And people did. I mean, people, there's accounts, I can't remember who it is, but there's an account of a British journalist in Windhoek in the 70s, in the beer cellars, with people celebrating Hitler's birthday in April. Yeah, I mean, Namibia was one of the places you went to you know, remember good old times.
I'll take it that film got shown on BBC 4, did it?
Yeah.
Did it get shown on BBC 2?
It did, yeah. Yeah. For Insomniacs. I think it was about 11:30. So, yeah. It's been, it was shown a number of times on BBC 4 and twice on BBC 2. Mm. And it's been shown in the kind of all the territories I could get the BBC to show it in. But they, what they won't do is give copies of films to companies, to countries that can't pay for things. So I made a film about Guyana and about the Indian indentured labour system, yeah. And we just eventually just put a table in envelope with no message and just gave it to the Namibian Broadcasting Corporation, because I mean to be honest, they actually just get buy things at Amazon and just play nationally broadcast films all the time, because they're such a small country and they've got no money that no one even takes notices. But yeah, it's been broadcast in as many places as I could. But you know, this film was made by default. It was just, you know, it was half made, it was cheap, and it was made because they, you know, they couldn't see a really good reason not to make it. But that, you know, that's another story I have to tell you, which I'm trying to avoid.
How do the other colonial powers use a kind of pseudoscience to wage wars? Were the Germans unique? Was it physiognomy, where they're sort of looking at the face and saying that?
Yeah, it's physiognomy and phrenology. The British do it as well. The British in what's now Zimbabwe, the British decided that the Ndebele were a warlike people, and they produced this book of physical studies to show how the warlike nature of the Ndebele was inherent, and it was stamped upon their bodily frame, as Darwin said. And then they used that to justify a policy of forced castration. And, you know, tens of thousands of Ndebele men were castrated, and it was all justified by the science. I guess the question is whether the science is ever the motivation, because I think it's almost always the justification, not the actual engine. Mm.
After all, the same type of physiognomy experiments were done on working class people in Europe in the 19th century.
Well, interestingly, Francis Galton went to Namibia. So Galton's first book, Travels in Southern Africa, is about Namibia. And one of the things that he did, he fell in love with a Hottentot woman. So I hate using this phrase, a Nama woman, but he called her Hottentot, the German racist phrase, which was used on Radio 4 the weekend. And he used a sextant to kind of measure her proportions. And so the father of eugenics was kind of the first person to carry out a physiological examination of the people of Southwest Africa. I always think that when you read those accounts of the fear of the inner city, and that's actually what my training was in, as a historian, is about British urban history. They do see the people of the inner city as savages, as a dangerous race who need to be studied in the same way, and may need to be restricted in their breeding in the same way. Mm-hmm. You can't get Maximins out in Whitechapel, but you can encourage selective breeding. And I think the parallels are so strong. I think it's the Americans who really take this
They have competition for the most Aryan families in the United States.
But I mean, some of the work Edmund Black's been doing about the American eugenics movement and the racial elements of it. So I bought a copy there's a fantastic book written in 1915. The Passing of the Great Race, which is referred to in The Great Gatsby. And when you, the paranoia about the idea that the white race might lose this inevitable racial war, is so strong in America. It's also fascinating, it's also very interesting that around the same time that the race that they become most fearful of is the Chinese. There's a great French novel in which the hero exterminates the entire population of China from an airship because a French woman gets raped in Paris in a bar by a Chinese woman, a Chinese man, and that they end up exterminating the entire population of China with gas bombs from an airship written in 1901. And this idea that if there's any doubt about the inevitability of Darwinism, this is what eugenics is. Eugenics is this fear that this isn't happening the way Darwin said it would. The unfit are outbreeding the fit. So that, Darwin says, here's the laws. The laws don't work. Well, once you're addicted to the laws, well, we'll just give them a helping hand. The Tasmanians was just supposed to die when we got there, die of disease. They're supposed to fade away. And Winwood Reed says, the British explorer, he says that the black people fade away the way that the snow melts in the front of the rays of the sun. Well, if that doesn't happen, then, well, we can give it a helping hand. If the working class are breeding a bit much, well, we can do something to sort that out, because these laws are our new religion. These laws are so important. We all are now modern social Darwinists. Well, we'll turn the blind eye, because it's so much more convenient than questioning these laws. So I think the eugenics movement and the idea of negative eugenics against the working class and the genocidal movements within late colonialism, most of which I think are famines rather than wars. I think in some ways Namibia is exceptional because it's so organised and so mechanised. I think they're part of the same phenomenon. I think maybe that's what stands out about this. It was just so over the top. The British would just have let people starve, like they did in India with about 22 million people. The British just didn't, just cost too much. I mean, the war that they fought cost 585 million marks. Now, the colony was worth about 50 million marks. The British would never have done this because an accountant in Whitehall would have just vetoed the whole thing. If anything's kind of distinctly German about, what happened in Namibia, it was so over the top. It was just so expensive and ridiculous to take 30 pieces of artillery to Waterberg. I mean, even now, getting to Waterberg is a nightmare. With roads and modern transport, to get oxen to carry 30 artillery pieces to Waterberg to kill the people who'd already stopped fighting—it's insanity. But then Germany wasn't a democracy.
Did many German working families go out to South Africa after the genocide?
They did. I mean, the population never grew to anything like they wanted to, because the farms need to be so large, because their cattle were in the land's marginal. They never got the population they wanted. It was about 14 million when the British and South Africans marched in 1915. What changed it, though, was not... See, they fought this war thinking that the great benefit, the great prize of the colony was cattle and land, and being able to ship beef to the Cape markets and then around the world in refrigerated ships. That's what they thought was the great economic prize. Well, just after the war, in a place called Lüderitz, they were building a railway, and a South African coloured worker who'd been working in the mines in Kimberley noticed something very familiar to him, which was a raw diamond. And there was a diamond boom started in 1911, and that's what transformed it. So it looks much better on paper than it actually is. And only at the beginning I used some pictures of a place called Kulmanskoop, a dead village, a dead, decaying town that's been consumed by the desert. That's the remnants of the diamond boom. And the diamond zone is just incredible. Because the British came in 1915, they'd just discovered another diamond zone, much richer deposit to the north, and the British just sealed it off, and it's exactly as it was. I mean, it's where the people who were marched dropped their spades. And no one goes in, because it's diamond zone, the surface diamonds. If you go and you get shot, I mean, literally, they have De Beers who runs it, have an ex-South African Defence Force hit squad. You can't go in there. And I got permission to go in after 4 years, and we still got arrested. But it was just, it's incredible. The whole thing has been left as it was. And that's what made the colony rich. So, and the great irony is, I mean, they spent all of that money trying to kill these exterminate people to run the, to have the cattle. And at the same time, the British were building a railway system in Argentina, which completely swamped the market of beef. Never made them a penny. So the whole thing was you know, in a much more efficient, kind of quiet British way. The British were just, you know, doing, you know, completely destroying their market by taking over Argentina.
Have they received any compensation to buy back their land?
No, no. The Germans offered them 20 million euros this year, and the paramount chief of the Herero refused. The court case is stalled. It's really hard to see. What Germany wants is to pay them a lot of money to have them go away on the condition that they say it wasn't a genocide. Now, what the Germans have done is they've said it was all about Lothar von Trotta. When von Trotta left, he killed about 25,000 of the Herero, people of about 80,000. It was the bureaucrats who killed most people, and they killed them in the camps. That's the fundamental problem. So, I mean, Germany, it's quite a brave thing what they did. They went to the Herero, to Hamakari, to the site of the Waterloo battle, and they said what General von Trotta did was genocidal. And that's absolutely true. But they won't use the word concentration camps. I was kicked out of the office of the German ambassador in Windhoek. And it's amazing what he said. We know that they were concentration camps. We know that that was the phrase they used, concentration camps. But if that's a direct translation of the phrase that the British MPs, Scott and Ellis, had come up with in the Boer War, we know, we actually accept this. And he said, but as Germans, we just don't like to use that word because of our history in it. We find it very upsetting. And it's not about you. It was absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
You know, he genuinely thought it was a reasonable position to not accept that you'd exterminated the people who now live in abject poverty on the fringes of a desert because it brings up other painful memories in your national history. And that's an incredible position. And I think it just shows how much the process of accepting Nazism has made Germany, well, all Germans, I think a very sizable proportion of the young generation of Germans has a completely different view. But the generations who lived in the shadow of the war, that they're incapable of accepting this. And I find it amazing that the Herero who live in really quite appalling conditions, some of them. I mean, there's a short piece in the film of people living right on the edge, on the Botswanan border. It's a nightmare getting there. I mean, Evangeline, who's sadly now dead, the old woman who had been born a slave. I mean, you know, she lived in that shack, you know, with her two cats on the edge of a desert. And her sons came, you know, when they could from working in the factories on the edge of the city, and made sure she was all right. And that's been her entire life. She was born in a concentration camp. She lived, you know, fleeing around the desert when the Germans were there. Then she lived through, you know, 70 years of apartheid. And that's been her entire life. And the idea that because of Germany's sensibilities about their history, we can't compensate. We can apologise to that woman. I find that kind of disgusting, but that's the thing you should say. But yeah, I don't think they will compensate. I think they're exploiting the poverty of the Herero to try to make them accept money, but to sign some sort of get-out clause to say that it wasn't a genocidal act. They're happy to say it was Trotta. They're happy to say he was this rogue soldier. What they cannot and won't accept is that they exterminated about 60,000 people in concentration camps, and that Shark Island was a death camp. That's what really bothers them as well, is because there are three sorts of camps in the Nazi system. There's collection camps, so there's concentration camps, there's labour camps, and there's death camps. Auschwitz is the only death camp, you know, that only does death camps, that only kills people. And the same three sorts of camps exist in Southwest Africa. I mean, they even move the people there on cattle trucks. I mean, so much of the terminology is the same. To accept that Shark Island was a death camp, they find immensely difficult, though it had no other purpose. They didn't work people there. They didn't use their labour. They systematically killed them. It's now, as you saw, it's now a campsite. They're building a restaurant overlooking it. And people sort of sit there. And Lüderitz is booming. I mean, since I made this film, Lüderitz has come through this incredible boom. And I went there. There's a shot at the beginning, which is a shot which was taken by a friend of a friend of skulls in the desert. And I went into that site. After 4 years of asking, we got permission to film in that mass grave, which is the only one that's come to light. And that's just, it's just incredible. I mean, there are just hundreds and hundreds of skulls, and they're mainly of women because most of the men have been killed in the war. And it is just breathtaking. But it's a mile from the town where you can go and sit and have drink very nice African wines over the site of the world's first death camp. And it's not in anyone's vested interest to accept that this happened. It's not in the Namibian government, it's definitely not in the German population of Namibia, it's not in the interests of any other European country for Germany to start saying, actually, the roots of our distorted 20th century history have go back into colonialism. And Belgium doesn't want that story coming up. Britain doesn't want to talk about it. It's in. No one who's got any money or power or influence has any purchase on these stories. They rarely don't matter.
Is there any precedent for colonial reparations?
There's not. No. There's precedent for colonial apologies. There's precedent for when you've lost a war. There's lots of that, and lots of people actually.
But there's statements of regret, which is what the Dutch inventors use, which is an illegal thing to say.
Whatever we're doing about slavery, there's always the question of reparations.
But the thing which is different about the Namibian thing is that Germany has paid, and I can't remember the figure in billions, but they passed a law in 1955 about compensating victims of their. The Holocaust. This law was not specifically about the Jewish Holocaust. The question that lawmakers, that a company in New York who have taken on the Herero case, are investigating is why does the Herero genocide, people who died in camps in Southwest Africa, why do they not, under the same law, become eligible for the billions of dollars that Germany has paid to Israel? That's the great precedent. It's not that it's a colonial thing, and it's almost about forgetting that distinction between colonial and non-colonial. Germany has paid billions in compensations for victims of organized, orchestrated, systematic liquidation of a population. And I don't know a single scholar in the genocide debate who doesn't think that Lemkin's definition, Lemkin who invented the word genocide in 1948, is part of the Nuremberg tangent.
Is that the reason why the German ambassador won't use the word?
I think it's just genuine. He just finds it upsetting, having to accept this. I mean, the addiction to the idea that the Nazis were an aberration. It's so strong. It
solves a lot of problems, doesn't it?
It makes sense of everything. And remember, you know, in 1945, Germany was asked to do two things. It was asked to say the Holocaust was our fault, the Second World War was our fault, and that we've caused a war that's killed 54 million people. Their kind of one bargaining chip was, well, let's say the First World War was a mistake. I mean, they literally, and you can read the negotiations, the kind of part of like the new denazification process. There was this need to say, well, the First World War, let's just kind of forget about that one. Hands up, everyone, bit of a mistake. But we'll throw ourselves into accepting that the Nazis were an aberration in our history, but part of our history, and there's no escaping that. And what's happened has happened, and we won't deny it. And that process, of, you know, really quite remarkable process of national self-flagellation, it's ruined by the story of the Herero.
Yeah, because the First World War is a tragedy, apparently. The Second World War has got something to do with evil.
Yeah.
There's no question in Britain. You know, the First World War is always presented. I was here today on the radio. The First World War is a tragedy.
Yeah.
It's just a horrific mistake, and a lot of people died. And the Second World War is clearly, you know, a point of focus about evil and, you know, the dangers of like these single-party states or something.
The thing I find fascinating is one of the kind of things I feel most fortunate about in my life is that I've interviewed 30 veterans of the First World War and British soldiers, and the thing which struck me, and I was very young when I did this, was that I went in with the Wilfred Owen view of the First World War, having at that point not read the story in which the letter to his mother in which he glorifies killing a German officer, but I went into the kind of dulce decorum view, and most of the veterans of the First World War I've met, they feel that what they did was they destroyed an evil state, which was the Kaiser's Second Reich. And they see the Kaiser Reich the way that we see the Third Reich. And they have no delusion. They thought Germany was an expansionist, racist, militaristic state that had plans for world domination. And they're very proud of it. And they don't feel themselves to be victims of the trenches and Passchendaele, those sort of things. They're the people who brought down Kaiser Bill. And everyone in the outside, the people I knew, were immensely proud of this. And because the history of the Third Reich eclipses that of the Second, we don't appreciate what the Kaiser's regime was. And it was a pretty frightening regime, especially in its last years. I think from 1897, when they had their first truly genocidal war, which is the war in East Africa, where they killed about a third of a million people, from that point onwards, it steamrolls. I mean, what Germany did in the Boxer Rebellion, it's off the scale, and everybody, all the countries, including Britain and America, who were involved in the punitive raid against the Boxers, carried out atrocities. But the Germans arrived after the war was over, and Waldersee, who was the Kaiser's best friend, and in some ways confidant, and possibly caseworker, just ran him up, because the Kaiser had told them to. The Kaiser had said, let all those who fall into your hands fall upon your sword, behave like Attila the Hun, so that no Chinaman would look askance at a German in 100 years' time. And they did that. The Kaiserreich was... If Hitler had never been born, if the Nazis had never come to power, and if the First World War had not happened, we'd still now look back and be making films and writing books about Kaiser Wilhelm and what a lunatic he was and how frightening Germany of the Second Reich was. We don't, because the Third Reich eclipses everything. So I have on and on and on. So.
Cheers. Recorded, so you'll be in trouble.
With oh shit! Yeah, right. Even if you won't exist for that 5 years.
Right, let's go.